We welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hi there, Colin.
Hey, what's going on, Kibble?
Oh, you know, just dodging the raindrops here, doing what we do. It does not stop you from getting to the obelisk or anywhere else that they've got stairs.
Cools me down. Rain is quite comfortable when one is running stairs, Kimball, as you know. It's good for stair running, good for singing, and just keeping one going and focused and all of that stuff. Dodge the drops, Kimball. Move those feet quickly.
Absolutely. We're going to talk Beatles in a little bit, but I did want to bring it up. We had chatted about it last night, and then you had a post on the blog today. Man, what a great baseball card from 1965 that you shared with Roger Craig, who passed away in the last couple days. And to look at that man 58 years ago and imagine he would still be with us is something else, because he did not look like your typical mid-30s guy.
He didn't. There were a bunch of baseball guys like this at the time. They could have a compelling, albeit strange, playoff. You have Bob Montgomery, Sparky Anderson, and I think Roger Craig would be a great contender. So he had a serviceable career. He won 3 world championships as a player and gained fame, of course, as a pitching coach. He was the pitching coach for the 84 Detroit Tigers, and then he was a pennant-winning manager with the San Francisco Giants. And if you had shown someone this baseball card a week ago, I was thinking, and I wrote, and said, this man, he's with us in the world. We technically could see him today if we were in the same place. I think that person you were talking to would say that you were a puller of legs in the extreme. There's just no way that it looks like this person in 1965 could have been here in 2023. And to me, more than anything, it's a reminder that, yeah, okay, there is a pitch clock on life, as I put it. But if you make the most of every at-bat, be you pitcher or hitter, the time is generous. You have enough time to do what you need to do. And that's what looking at Roger Craig's 1965 baseball card has made me reflect on this week.
Yeah, I think, if I remember right, too, he was the father of the split-fingered fastball.
That was his, yeah, right. That was his sort of other big claim to fame in addition to his championships. And think of how that pitch transformed the game of baseball, how it transformed individual careers, what it made certain guys. Think of what it made Roger Clemens. I was watching that April game against the Mariners from 86 when Clemens strikes out 20 guys. He's throwing gas on like every pitch. I mean, with curveballs mixed in, but it's 90% fastballs, regular fastball, and then breaking balls. Roger Clemens doesn't go on and do a lot of the stuff that he subsequently does. You can't just throw fastballs 90% of the time, no matter who you are, forever and have success with it without that split finger pitch. Think of Mike Scott. Think of Curt Schilling. These guys that were unhittable either for a point in time or for long stretches of their career. So yeah, that's a pretty cool pitch, that split finger, and Roger Craig gets the credit for that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We're going to talk Beatles, and let's first give a little listen to a session from 1963, The Beatles.
Crying, crying, waiting, waiting, hoping, hoping you'll come back. I just can't seem to get you out my mind. Crying.
We've talked about some of these BBC sessions before, Colin, but this session from July 16th, 1963, well, you sum it up. You say it's quite obviously one of the most remarkable sessions in rock and roll history.
The February session from earlier in the year that netted Please Please Me at a length of 585 studio minutes is the more famous session, but this one might be more impressive in terms of its range. Now, the Beatles were busy guys in 1963, which is really their best year, the year in which they shine the most, I would say, if you look at the whole spectrum of their work. And a big portion of that work are these BBC appearances. So they come into the BBC studios and they have to crank out a lot of material to tide everything over so these songs can be spread out over multiple broadcast sessions. So you're going to get a lot of material and you're going to get a huge amount of breadth that is going to be moving from one style to another, one artist from another, and of course doing their own songs. And what we just heard there was George Beadle singing Buddy Holly's Crying, Waiting, Hoping, which was a song that really served Harrison's voice well. Buddy Holly would sing in that wobbly style intentionally, and George Harrison, especially right now, was a kind of wobbly singer, and he acquits himself well too on guitar throughout this session. And if someone is oriented just towards guitar solos as being the indicator of guitar player's prowess, what you're going to want to listen to and for are Harrison's fills, these ornamental touches that he has. And he's just very confident throughout as a guitar player, more confident than he was on record at the time. This is a looser sort of deal. We're informal sessions, like hanging around up in the Beatles treehouse, is how I've always looked at it. So yeah, that's one of the Buddy Holly numbers that we have here.
The sound quality of this music is absolutely incredible.
It worked out that way. Doesn't always work out that way. And I figured a guy like you would appreciate that. Sometimes these things survived. Sometimes these things were recorded off the air by dogged believers. In fact, in between songs at one point, there's a dedication to the Beatles tape collectors out there, like this group, right? Because you actually have people writing in. And it's telling sometimes when people write in with what they request. There is, for instance, a number of young women, the three Beatlettes, as they call themselves, who write in for a request of "I Just Don't Understand," the Anne Margaret song. And it's like, why would you request that? How would you know about that? Did they? You must have either known them or an offhand chance performance. I don't think any of these things were on the fake. I think these were legitimate letters that came in. There's a joke where someone says, "We don't believe that you write these letters, or that you didn't write these letters, and we believe you wrote this." So there's a clever bit of intertextuality. But if you just made this its own mixtape, if you will, and just took this session and said, okay, July 16th, 1963 is the name of this album, you would have one of the go-to Beatles albums, in my estimation.
And it covers, as you said, such a breadth of music and influences, the things that they liked and they were listening to. I love their version of the old Teddy Bears hit, Phil Spector's To Know Her Is to Love Her, and their version of it. The harmonies are so great on this.
It's one of my all-time favorite Beatles performances, as was that version of I Just Don't Understand. And I've loved this cover for so long. And you remember how Mel Torme was the Velvet Fog, kind of a cool nickname. I think of this Lennon vocal. You could call him like the Merseyside Haze. This is that classic John Lennon voice. He only has that voice really for 1 year. It's 1963, and it goes into 64 too. You'll hear it on the Hard Day's Night album, and I Should Have Known Better, especially, is a good example of it. But it's going to change after that, and even like into the second half of 1964. This is Lennon at his vocal toppermost of the poppermost. And people like to think that Paul McCartney was the one who did the so-called saccharine material. I don't really ever find it that saccharine because of the quality of the performance and the commitment to the material. But this would fall into that ostensible McCartney camp. But here you have Lennon doing the song as if it means the world to him. You'd think he was eulogizing his mother, Julia, with it. So it's, yeah, the harmonies. And they're sort of like weird harmonies, too, because they're on that word, para, 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 like that. And they're just they're so in the pocket with each other, and it has these kind of shifts in the material where you have to be bang on, or there's going to be these gaps, these seams will show. And they were just incredibly tight throughout this particular recording day.
And then some of the original performances, the version of Please Please Me that they do in this BBC session, to me, is far superior than the single version that was released.
Well, Kimbo, I noted your enthusiasm last night. Like, oh, wow, Kimbo. So I was wondering what you were going to say, and I didn't know, but I should be like, easy, Kimball. But it is very good, and it's highly energetic. It's also helped by the sound balance. You get this sense of the pedal point bass of Paul McCartney, and that's something that comes through. They're very much a rhythm and blues band, and they're a soul band. And for you to be a soul band in the early 1960s, you need a lot of bottom with your sound. You need that bass drum kicking and that bass itself throbbing. And you have that happening with Please Please Me. They're into it. They're obviously gassed to be at this particular session. For whatever reason, they had the good energy that day. Lennon digs into those come on the end like you really want him to, and which he does, to be fair, on the studio version, but maybe not all the time on the various live versions. So they're spirited. They're up for it. They kick off with that cover from the first Elvis album of I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Cry Over You. And I want people out there who think that Ringo Starr was just being carried by these guys to have a listen to either that or any of these numbers. He is the driver of this band. He is the instrumental driver. It does not work without him. And his playing on I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Cry Over You, it harkens to his playing on Rain. I was like, whoa, you can't go from July 16th, 1963 at the BBC to Revolver. But yeah, I did. And you can. It's that same sort of level of Keith Moon feel playing. It's all of these rhythmic embellishments, and he is driving that band. And, I mean, it's like proto-Bonham. But Bonham wasn't. He wasn't as swift as Ringo Starr. He was much more lumbering than Ringo Starr is on this. I mean, he drives this band. You're also getting the first BBC version of She Loves You. And it's another number where it's worth thinking about Starr. The single most orgastic moment in all of Western recorded sound is that cymbal wash after the opening chorus of She Loves You. And you get a big sense of that in this live version. And again, you didn't always. You would in the live version from the Hollywood Bowl, but this is that same kind of orgastic rush that happens with the official single version, which was cut on July 1st. So here we are, July 16th. It's a little more than 2 weeks later. The single hasn't even come out yet. And as with many things that are brilliant before other people say they're brilliant, Rodney Burke, the gregarious, appealing host, he doesn't really say that much about it when they play it the first time. And then later, when they repeat an airing for a different segment, a different broadcast of the same song, he's like, oh, I think it'll probably be a hit. Because people need other people to say things en masse and first and together, and then they'll pile on. But here we see that even with Beatles.
And you look at the time period, July of 63, very few people in America knew who the Beatles were, but they were in the midst of the first wave of British Beatlemania at that point.
They were. This was a phenomenon confined to 1963 for them. If you knew who they were in America, you would have been someone at Capitol Records, perhaps, that was receiving a communique from George Martin and basically ignoring it. So this is their, England, it's like New England. You have to keep in mind how small England was. And this was the big time for them. This was the right in the meaty part of that big time. And so that's another reason they're up for something like this. It's very exciting. This isn't something a year prior. We'll go back a year prior. Starr is, he's not in the band. So, I mean, think of how much change that is you hadn't written She Loves You. You hadn't had your debut single come out. You hadn't had the recording session for your first album. Your first album hadn't been released. You hadn't had chart hits. So you were still going to be going to Hamburg again. So, I mean, you know, it's happening fast, as they say, Kimball.
And you've talked before about how in the early days, Lennon was the vocal star of the band and recorded the majority of the lead vocals and some great Lennon performances on these sessions. I love his work on I Got a Woman.
Yeah, and I Got a Woman, their version of it's interesting because Rhythm and Blues number by Ray Charles. And Ray Charles was one of those guys, like an Arthur Alexander. If you're going to cover Alexander or Charles, you better have your stuff together. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you can't suck, or you're going to sound anodyne. And everyone's going to be like a pimply loser white guy over there. So you get the rhythm and blues of Ray Charles, but there's also a countryfied element, which is interesting because Ray Charles obviously had made some forays into that direction himself. And it's like the Beatles were able to overlay those two parts of Ray Charles into this song. Because if you listen to Ray Charles's version of the tune, it's not countryfied. It's just simply rhythm and blues. So you have this stop and go part at the end too. And again, Star is just bang on. Now you have some lyrical components that anticipate the Beatles' own Run for Your Life. And I know everyone's supposed to be like, oh, that's so bad. Whatever. I like them both. I think they're awesome. I think it's funny. And you know what? Lennon thought it was funny too. Okay, granted, these guys were chauvinists, right? Especially at the time. Hmm. When Lennon says the thing about the woman with the hand around the home, he audibly laughs. Like, he's like, ladies. We'll substitute a different word in there. But I don't know. It's of its time, and you know what? Most people, they're just pretending anyway to be things that they're not. So at least here, they were musically embodying something, and you can say it's satire or whatever. That's fine, but it's just a great rhythm and blues performance.
Yeah, and they were doing, for a band that was still relatively new, they were playing in so many different styles at that time. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with their work in the clubs where you had to play a lot of covers and take a lot of requests, and you had to be able to play almost anything.
It did, to a degree, but other bands had the same pedigree that they did, and they weren't doing what the Beatles were in terms of range. So they were there too. The Beatles weren't the only act going over to Hamburg, for instance, or they weren't the only ones at the time playing the Jacaranda. They weren't the only ones at the Cavern. And if you have the version of this material that includes performances by the likes of the Swingin' Blue Jeans and the Hollies, because they were part of these broadcasts too. So you move from like the Beatles to the Swingin' Blue Jeans, then back to the Beatles. You get this culture shock within the same broadcast. It's like I do on the blog with like really bad writing, and I put it next to my writing, like the Pepsi Challenge. This is the music version of the Pepsi Challenge, and they were open, and they had interest as record collectors, as music fans, that outpace that of other bands. And when they cover, for instance, with McCartney singing the Honeymoon song, I've always loved that. It was a 1959 film by Michael Powell, our old friend, late in his career of Powell and Pressburg. Mm. But he's just Michael Powell at that point. Schmaltzy, kitschy. But McCartney sings it so well. And again, they're all committed to the material. You get a real sense for how important Carl Perkins was to this band, when you have that George Harrison cover of Glad All Over.
Yeah.
Think about Carl Perkins, kind of like awkward, aw shucks, right? Whereas Elvis is the dude who's just showing up and he's like, I'm the man, this is over, I'm just going to kill it, and everyone else is going to feel like they can't compete with me. Carl Perkins was more like, I don't know, a character out of the Andy Griffith Show. And I think that suited George Harrison really well. Listen to how he sings Glad All Over and how strong his guitar playing is. That was where he was coming from as a guitar player. It wasn't from Chuck Berry. He couldn't play like Chuck Berry. He had to play Chuck Berry songs and Chuck Berry type of things. But he was a country and western picker, of all things, George Harrison, in his heart during these early days. So he is someone who, if anyone is down on him, he really shines throughout.
And I think it's something like 19 songs in this session. And then I scroll down on the list of all those BBC recordings and then see that the next day they were back in there and recorded another four songs.
Yeah, and July 16th was, I believe, actually the air date for the earlier July session, which
right.
I wrote about for Rolling Stone, and we've talked about, and is in one of my Beatles books, where they said, okay, Elvis, okay, Arthur Alexander, okay, Chuck Berry, we're taking on your stuff, and we'll show you who's better. And they just went through the gauntlet like that, dropped in a version of There's a Place. And I think that that aired on the day that this extended session was cut. They do the B-side to She Loves You and I'll Get You. And that's another one where we, again, it's Lennon and McCartney singing together, but Lennon a little bit more than McCartney, they would do that. And when it's both of them and it's one of them a little bit more than the other, usually Lennon. But you have that patty cake, hand clap routine at the beginning. It just creates this jiving rhythm. There's an innocence to it, but there's also a proto Jealous Guy, the Lennon solo song to it. It's like, I'll get you. I mean, it's like, oh, I'll get your love. And that, okay, fine. But it's also like, yeah, well, it's a little something dark and sinister here, lady, if you're not digging the dog, if you know what I mean. So that's they were able to walk both sides of the river, so to speak.
And all these recordings are out there, but you were telling me that if you want to find it, a lot of versions are better than other, and sometimes the unofficial versions of these recordings are better and not as over-processed as some of the official ones.
Well, like Mr. T, I pity the fool who is reliant on the official releases. There what? Two of them? First came out in the mid-90s, and then there was a follow-up version. The sound is highly compressed. It's over-processed in an attempt to, ironically, clean it up, make it more listener-friendly. You don't want to box in any strong artist. You don't want to box in the Beatles. Let the sound breathe. There are all of these. Now, I could have sent you links to things last night. It would have been very easy for you to get. But I figure you're probably on a Mac. They would have been FLAC files. And it's easy to do. I mean, I'm not so great at this stuff, and even I can do it. You're probably better at it. You just would have had to convert the FLAC files to MP3 if you had a Mac, and you would have had the entire thing. So I could hook you up at some point. But, yeah, your people out there are going to want to find the unofficial versions, and they're completer. Now, you can get, like, for instance, one version where it's just the Beatles, and it doesn't have the flavor of the time interspersed. You can get like another version, the BBC Archives version, where, like I said, you're going to be going from the Beatles to the swinging blue jeans, and it's cool. It depends how much you're into that stuff. Like this is really like bad joke that the swinging blue jeans try to make to start like their next performance. And the host is like, oh, wow, this is so contrived what we're doing. He just says it. It's like it is really amusing. These guys all had a certain humorous sensibility, people from that part of England, of course. It was known for humor because you had to have humor. It was a kind of depressing sort of gray and rainy life in the post-war pre-Beatles era.
Kudos to the people at the BBC, though, because I think the attitude in those days was that pop groups were pretty disposable and they might not be around for long. And a great job by them of getting all of this recording and getting these sessions and having this great library of early Beatles music.
True. I mean, they erased a lot of it. So there's also that. The BBC, they were always great erasers, like Doctor Who. See ya. I mean, they were always erasing stuff. And the Beatles weren't certainly the only act that had this. I was listening to, this will salivate you, Gimble. I was listening to a very rare off-the-air meaning someone held up a tape recorder to their radio, recording of The Who on the BBC doing Baby, Don't You Do It. So that's pretty crazy. But the reason I was able to even listen to this is because of my dogged searching and that it had been erased in the first place. So I think that Rodney Burke, he's the host, it's not Brian Matthew here. I think that he is, he gets on great with these guys. They like him. And he's taking them seriously. I mean, he's taking them as someone in a time machine going back then would take them. And there's this really, it's later on, a little bit after this session. This is for Pop Go the Beatles. So they're doing Pop Goes the Weasel. And it's the Beatles actually playing and John Lennon blowing harmonica. And that's the name of this particular installment of their stint on the BBC. But when they wrap up the end of the series with this guy, Rodney Burke, they sing like this little song for him. And then they dedicate the last song they're going to do for this show to each other. So Paul McCartney says, this is Paul. I dedicate this to John, George, and Ringo. And then they all go around like that. And Burke says, what's it going to be? And they all say in unison, Twist and Shout. And they give this version of Twist and Shout where they're fully committed. It was a song where you couldn't always be fully committed because it messed up Lennon's voice. But they really go for it. It might be the second best version after the famous closer from Please Please Me.
Well, check it out. Again, you can find it online of the Beatles live at the BBC, particularly those recordings from July 16th, 1963. Colin, appreciate it as always. And appreciate the Roger Craig memories, too. We'll talk with you again next week.
All right, sounds good.